Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast, sponsored by The Nation magazine and widely available on all podcast platforms. The news from Israel and Palestine continues to dominate headlines. What we're witnessing is one of the most ferocious, if not the most ferocious war we've seen in the 21st century. In terms of the pace of killing and civilian deaths, including the deaths of children, at a level that, is rare even among horrific wars that we've seen elsewhere in Syria and in Ukraine. I want to take up the issue of the relationship of the United States to all this. And to do so, I'm very happy to have on Youssef Maner, who's the head of the Palestine-Israel program at Washington, D.C., and is one of the sort of outstanding Palestinian voices on these issues. And I guess we should start with, I want to put four squarely the political issue of the Biden administration and its handling of this, because I think for Americans in particular, that is very important to think about. And since the start of this, Biden has followed what people are calling a bear hug strategy. And I think that strategy and its failure gets at a lot of what's going on.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me on, G. I mean, one of the challenges that the Israelis say they face and actually quite resent when it comes to bombing Gaza, which is, of course, something we've seen over and over again, is that they feel that they have limited time to achieve their stated objectives. And the amount of time that they have is really a product of sort of international opinion about the way that they're conducting these bombardments, which of course leads to outrage and pressure from the Western governments, which they rely on to effectively wrap it up. And they've seen this numerous times. We saw it, of course, in 2021 during the Biden administration when an Israeli bombardment of Gaza began was shortly after the Israelis destroyed a high-rise building housing the offices of the Associated Press and Al Jazeera on live TV at the time, that there was a real outcry, and it led to the U.S. government effectively telling the Israelis it's time to wrap this up. This time around, I think very early on, the Israelis and the Americans agreed that the Israelis wanted as much time as they could get to try to do what they wanted to do in Gaza. And we're seeing that on full display. And what they're doing is horrific. Mass destruction of civilian architecture, infrastructure, and a rate of killing, as you point out, that rivals some of the most horrific, horrific things that we've seen over the last many decades. In fact, I saw that Nick Kristof in the New York Times noted that it was the fastest pace of killing of innocents that he's seen since the Rwandan genocide. So this is the situation on the ground. And I think, you know, when you talk about the bear hug strategy, part of that was not just a commitment to provide Israel with the weapons that it needs to do what it wants to do to Palestinians in Gaza, but also to provide it with the political space, and really through the participation in the information war, in ways that I have never seen the United States be such a willing participant and in such a fully committed way. It really contrasts with anything we've seen from American administrations in prior episodes of Israel bombing the Gaza Strip, so much so that, you know, today even the Israeli military spokesman came out and pushed back against the State Department spokesperson here in the United States, which was pushing this line about Israeli hostages not being released by Hamas because Hamas is sexually abusing them and doesn't want to let them out because of that. I mean, it's got to the point where the Israeli military is telling the U.S. State Department, hey, you know, slow down. Your pro-Israel line is getting a little bit too extreme even for us, right? and I think, like, this is,
That's right, I mean, it's crazy
when you think about it, but this is where we're at, right?
Yeah, no, it's an astonishing thing that, you know, I guess there's the phrase more Catholic than the Pope. And that is Joe Biden is right now.
The Israeli ambassador to the United States at the outset of this war, he gave an interview to CNN, which I remember vividly. He said, look, you know, historically, the United States has always been there to give us a hug on the first day of the war. We want to make sure that you guys are still willing to give us that hug weeks and months into this thing. And, you know, the Biden administration has been doing that the entire time. And they tried to message this at the outset as a strategy that would help them kind of shape Israeli behavior on the ground. They said that, you know by publicly embracing the Israelis to the full extent, no matter what they're doing on the ground in Gaza, you know, we'll be able to kind of guide Israeli behavior and limit what they're doing and try to control the situation. But this has failed at every step of the way. Early on, they said they wanted to try to avoid a ground invasion. A ground invasion happened. They said they wanted to avoid attacks on civilians. We saw that go, you know, in the opposite direction in a very significant way. We, you know, seen them say that they want to avoid attacks on the health infrastructure. And then they ended up not only attacking the health infrastructure, but the United States became a willing supporter of it through its rhetoric as well. So even, you know, if you...
And even now, where they're saying we don't want to replicate in the south of what
it's
happened in the north.
And it's been happening throughout.
It's right? happening. Yeah.
So the idea that this so-called bear hug strategy is working in modifying Israeli behavior, there's just no real evidence of that. All of the evidence that we have actually points to the contrary. That U.S. support, unchecked support for Israel, has enabled the horrific sort of excesses that we've seen at a time where you're seeing, you know, this war set all kinds of records for the killing of children and for journalists and for aid workers. It's horrifying and disgraceful.
Absolutely, yeah. And I want to also add, just in terms of, like, the American national interest, like, you know, this strategy of, like, basically giving Israel a blank check and then but occasionally putting in rhetorical rejoinders, well, maybe try not to do that, and then having Israel, you know, like, completely ignore whatever it is that the American cautions are. Like, this, from the outside, it makes America look very weak. like it actually makes Biden look like, you know, he's not in charge, that he's being led around by Israel, and that it undermines American the way American is seen around the world. And we've seen that especially like sort of in the global South, where there's been a lot of criticism and a lot of people basically saying, you know, like, you know, you have this rhetoric of human rights, the liberal international order. And, you know, like we clearly see what nonsense this is. So like even, you know, leaving aside the humanitarian concerns, like this seems like you're undermining America's own position in the world in very tangible ways.
You're absolutely right. And the ways in which this impacts American interests are really, really profound. You know, first and foremost, you have the situation in the region. You know, the Biden administration has sent aircraft carriers to the Mediterranean, submarines into the region at a time where there is a major war, when there are regional militias, all of which who have their fingers on the trigger. And the United States is sending more military assets into a region that could immediately blow up into a bigger regional conflagration that would drag the United States into a major regional war again in the Middle East. And, you know, the person who may have the most control over that situation, Benjamin Netanyahu, is somebody who has long dreamt of getting the United States into a major confrontation with Iran. And for the Biden administration to essentially outsource this kind of decision to someone like Benjamin Netanyahu, I mean, it's the height of insanity. You know,
it's terrifying. It is, exactly. And I want to just underscore, like, a lot of the Israeli behavior, the Israeli government behavior seems deliberately a provocation to create that eventuality. Like, what I can't understand, like, in the context of having a war in Gaza, to like also allow the settlers like free reign to conduct lynching campaigns in the West Bank, and to have allow the march through the Temple Mount, like all of these are like sort of provocative actions, which almost seem designed to really, you know, test militia groups and Iran, and you know, provoke exactly that sort of regional confrontation, which like is absolutely not in the interest of like the United States or really most people in the world. Like, the, you know, like
it's
another Middle East war.
And it's important to understand that before this most recent war, we were already seeing the most far-right extremist government in Israeli history, filled with ideologues who would love to use the opportunity of a major war to advance their vision for an Israel that is free of Palestinians and one that you know, dominates the entire territory between the Mediterranean River and the Jordan Sea. This is part of their vision for the future. And you know, they're absolutely using every opportunity they can to pour fuel on the fire. I just want to say, though, it's not just about a regional war where this implicates American interests. It's much bigger than that. Look at what's happening with Ukraine now. The United States is completely distracted from that.
Yeah.
It's close to not being able to continue financing that. This has been the primary foreign policy focus of this administration, and it's entirely been thrown to the wayside because of the you know, bear hug, if you will, approach to this Israeli war on Gaza. Look at what it's doing to American credibility and opinion in the global South, right? This idea that the Biden administration has put forward throughout its campaigning on Ukraine, that the United States is upholding the global rules-based order and international law and all this stuff, it's just been completely blown to pieces, you know? American allies in the region, the Jordanians, the Egyptians, Gulf states, all of them, are all facing instability because of the situation that continues and the bombardment of Gaza. And many of them are making trips over to China, making trips over to Russia to see if somebody else can help bring some sanity to this part of the world. And this is not good for the United States. So the extent to which it is, you know, going, it doesn't suit American interests. It also, in my view, and perhaps we can segue to this, doesn't suit the interests, the electoral interests of President Biden either. And it's really hard to wrap one's head around what he's thinking. And the only thing I can sort of conclude is that the man personally is a committed Zionist. And he's told us that a lot. It's hard to understand his behavior in any other way.
Yeah, no, I think that's Biden's motivations for this are very interesting, because it is something that is, you know, fracturing his own party and his own coalition. And then this is, like, you know, not just at the level of protesters, but like we've seen White House staff, make dissents. We've seen dissent channels within the State Department, and congressional staffers also going to like vigils and circulating dissent from this policy. So like at like every level, and certainly donors and others, and in crucial Midwestern states where there's a considerable number of Muslim Americans and Arab Americans were not happy with us. It's going to, and where Biden, only squeaked through barely in a victory. The sort of electoral consequences are very dubious. And all opinion polls show that, you know, the strongest support for the war comes from Republicans, and that, like, if you look at Democrats and independents, they're like much more dubious about what's going on. So you're basically having a policy that's geared towards pleasing people who are never going to vote for you, and which are going to make unhappy the people who do vote for you, and might discourage enough of them not to vote. So the electoral calculation doesn't make a lot of sense. But the point you said about Biden being a Zionist, I think that that's not emphasized enough. Like, there's an element of ideology here, and it's partially an element of age. You know, this is a man who's 80 years old. He came of age in the 50s and 60s, when sort of liberal Zionism was a major kind of force in American culture, and well outside the Jewish community, that there was a kind of affinity between liberalism and Zionism at that point, and people who did see Israel as a kind of shining beacon of democracy, and even in some cases of socialism, who are very committed to that. And we've seen this at many points at Biden's career, including like in the 1980s with the war in Lebanon, where, you know, like at one point, like Ronald Reagan, who's president at that time, went to the talked to the Israeli prime minister, Begin, and told him, you know, Begin, what's happening is a Holocaust. It has to stop. And we have reports of Biden at that time saying, you know, like, he's totally on board with what's happening in Lebanon. So in the 1980s, Joe Biden was Begin, to the right of Ronald Reagan.
Right, who himself at the time said, Menachem Begin, you know, I had to disassociate myself from the extreme comments of the Senator Biden, who was, you know, taking this extreme position. I mean, this is Menachem Begin, the guy that was the leader of the terrorist Irgun party, right? Like, this is not some peacenik we're talking about, right?
Yeah.
And Joe Biden was, you know, more of a gung-ho, go kill the Arab Zionist than Menachem Begin. I mean, this is the guy who's president of the United States today. And I think it's not just that he is from an older generation. And there's no doubt that there is a generational divide in the way that people view this issue, not just a partisan divide, but a generational one as well. It is because he, and there's plenty of evidence of this, is more to the right, more ideologically committed as a Zionist than the average 80-year-old Democrat, right? And you're right, the electoral calculus doesn't make sense. And look, I think it's important to note here, when it comes to national security issues, the electoral calculus shouldn't be the determining factor, right? National interest should be the determining factor.
No.
But it doesn't make sense in terms of the American national interest. It doesn't make sense in terms of the domestic political calculus. So what is this about? I mean, I'm left only to believe that it is about Biden's ideology. I think it's obviously has devastating consequences for Palestinians first and foremost on the ground in Gaza. But it's going to have a ripple effect that's going to impact Americans, and it's certainly going to impact, I think, the Democratic Party. One thing I would note about the electoral piece, you are absolutely right that there are certain states where specific constituencies could play an outsized role in determining the outcome, like the Arab and Muslim community in Michigan, for example. And that's part of the story. But I think another important part of the story, which often gets missed when talking about the impact of this war on the election, is that it's not just these constituencies that care about this issue anymore. It's not just an Arab issue or a Palestinian American or Muslim issue, right? Increasingly, different constituencies, including younger voters and people of color, have adopted the issue of Palestine as a litmus test on support for justice. And it becomes a prism through which many people view candidates and their commitment to justice. And so the impact of this is going to be much bigger than just within those constituencies. And I think, you know, it's unclear exactly how it's going to play out, but there are tons of red flags right now for anyone trying to put together a winning coalition for the Democrats in next year's election.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what we're seeing from, like, not just all the pollings, but I think if you just go out to, like, any of the protest, there are real divides along generational lines and along racial lines, frankly. And the sort of, you know, the Democratic Party, you know, just based on like what the coalition is and how they won, you know, elections in the last century, like if they don't have young people, if they don't have people of color, they're in big trouble.
It's not just winning a majority of young people. I mean, one of the key drivers for Biden's election victory in 2020 was not just that he won young people, but that they turned out in greater numbers than they had turned out before. And so, you know, if you ask young people, you know, would you rather have Biden over Trump or Trump over Biden? They're probably not going to say that they would rather have Trump over Biden. But the question is, are they going to be motivated to go out and support Biden in the ways that were required to deliver a victory in 2020? What we're seeing right now suggests the exact opposite.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And in some ways, I mean, you know, I think the generational divide, as you say, Biden is to the right of what even like 80-year-old Democrats think. And certainly, like, you know, one of the interesting things is that where the shift in polling is coming from those older Democrats, you know, who were initially like all on board with Israel. And as the war has progressed, have become disenchanted with it. So I think he's going to even, like, you know, be discouraging those voters as well. It seems very problematical. And the other thing I would kind of like add is, like, you know, the longer the war goes on and the more it dominates headlines, like, you know, the less attention there is to, like, Trump. Like, in some ways, like, Trump has vanished from, like, news coverage, despite the fact that there's a lot of things going on where, like, on the one hand, he's, you know, has all these court problems. And then also he's saying, like, incredibly incendiary stuff about wanting to be a dictator. And, you know, the Democrats complain, well, this stuff is not getting attention. But, you know, like, it's hard for that to get attention if there's a war going on. so you're just on, like, as you said, you know, this stuff should be decided on a policy matter. What is in America's national security? And that national security also, I would say, includes issues of value, Like, you cannot, you know, disentangle America's national interest from some support of human rights and norms of international law. So, on every front, it's very bad. Something we talked about before we started recording is the issue of kind of the strategies of distraction that we're kind of seeing now. Certainly there were hearings held in Congress inviting heads of universities, and that took up a lot of attention. And I think you've written about how, you know, this has to be seen as a kind of not just an anti-free speech thing to try to, like, you know, have a chilling effect on criticism of Israel and academia, but also as a way of distracting from
happening on the ground. Something I heard a Zionist activist say years ago, a Zionist activist based in Europe who works closely with the Israeli government, was doing a webinar. And one of the things that he said that has long stuck with me, he said, look, you know, if we're debating whether or not Zionism is anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is anti-Zionism. If we're having that debate, even if we are losing that debate, at least the debate is about that, and it's not a debate about whether Israel is an apartheid state, right? And so, you know, it becomes a device of distraction to kind of make the debate about that. But more so, I think it's also part of a longstanding strategy of repression. A strategy of transnational repression that, honestly, there's not enough attention on when it comes to the conversation about transnational repression, which we are hearing more about in recent years. And, you know, this has developed over time as a Israeli government response to dissent in global civil society, specifically as a response to efforts to boycott, divest, and sanction Israel. And the Israelis realized that they had a problem with BDS, with boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And the problem was specifically that it was nonviolent dissent. The Israelis were far more comfortable dealing with Hamas, right? They outgunned them significantly. Yes. And, you know, none of their allies are really going to question the use of fierce repression against violent attacks, right? But nonviolent dissent presents a completely different challenge. And as one Israeli general once said, we don't do Gandhi very well, right? This was sort of the perspective. And so the strategy in the Israeli government that developed over time as a way to respond to this was to rebrand nonviolent dissent as inherently violent or discriminatory, right? And so the effort became an attempt to connect nonviolent dissent through boycotts, divestment, and sanctions to terrorism or anti-Semitism. And actually, the Israeli government agencies who were involved in this are quite transparent about the effort. In doing so, they hope then to piggyback on existing anti-terrorism law and anti-discrimination law, which circumvents First Amendment and free expression protections, to be able to target dissenters in third countries, whether it's in the United States or Europe. So now you're seeing, for example, protesters in Europe being arrested for protest chants, right, that are deemed anti-Semitic, right? They were never deemed anti-Semitic before, right? But now, because you can brand the chant as anti-Semitic, you can then bring in hate crimes law or law enforcement in other ways to shut down protests. This is how transnational repression in the Israel context operates. And we've seen it go into overdrive in the last couple of months. And I think the show trial that we saw the other day in Congress, which was, you know, designed to generate outrage with these presidents, is part and parcel of this broader strategy.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense, and certainly one can see its effectiveness, particularly in Europe, where, you know, they don't have the First Amendment and they have stronger traditions, particularly in Germany, of sort of suppression of speech that's seen as discriminatory, for, you know, for obvious historical reasons. But I also have to wonder, like, ultimately how effective this is, because from what I'm seeing from the polling, and this includes polling in Europe, you know, like this war is becoming less and less popular. You know, if you ask people, you know, more broadly, I think in many Western countries, like, you know, the general feeling is that they want their governments to be even-handed. And certainly we've seen some of the largest protests, you know, since in the last 20 years, anti-war protests, like all over the world. So how effective is this, like, actually, like, in achieving its goal? Like, it seems like, to me, it seems like public opinion is
I really appreciate your opening with Gramsci, because to me, this is evidence of hegemony shattering. And I think this is what we are seeing now. Yeah. And so, you know, I think Gramsci would tell us that, you know, real power is the ability to control and shape behavior without having to actually wield power and without actually having to wield repression. But when hegemony shakes, and we are seeing today in the United States, a real pushback against what has been the traditional blank check pro-Israel line that continues to dominate the official sort of policymaking circles from below, from protests from younger generations and so on. And the response to that shaking hegemony has been, this effort at repression. And I think that only catalyzes the dynamic of shattering that hegemony over time. I think we are seeing people increasingly realize that what's happening is silencing and intimidation and an effort to distract. And I think the cat's out of the bag. You know, it's going to be a very turbulent and disruptive period in the years to come. But once hegemony breaks, it's really hard to put back together again. And defending apartheid has become very, very difficult to do. And I think it's only becoming more difficult over time. You know, after previous episodes of massive Israeli bombardments on Gaza, whether it's 2008, 9, 2014, one of the outcomes of that has been a tremendous growth in global civil society activism to demand for accountability. We saw that in 2010. We saw that in 2015 in the response to that. And that's something that the Israeli government is significantly worried about, because the war on Gaza this time is orders of magnitude greater than the ones that we saw in 2008 and 2014. Mm-hmm. And the global response, I think we should expect in terms of people being politicized and mobilized to demand for accountability, will be orders of magnitude greater as well.
Yeah, no, I think that's, I think that we're already seeing that happening, and I think that's actually a good note to end on. So I want to thank you for being on. This has been a really illuminating discussion.